Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the very first Cinema Clash of 2021. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined as always by my physically distanced, for everyone's safety, co-host Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Happy New Year, Charlie.
Happy New Year. I know everyone was excited to turn over a new leaf. 2021! No way it's going to be like 2020. Guess what? But some things never change. I am sipping on a 2013 Tempranillo, which is going down very well, and it's a good, it's a welcome throttle back, because during this week, I don't know if you were watching the news, but where we are in Washington, D.C., I was drinking whiskey and bourbon, watching domestic terrorism and treason, so now I am throttling back to our standard red wine business.
Yeah, I am drinking water because I think I already reached my maximum amount of alcohol over the past few days. So I'm switching to good old H2O this evening for us to talk about the latest movies coming our way.
Well, the good news for our listeners is we're going to talk about three main ones, and then we're going to branch out into the little onesies twosies that we have been watching separately. But the two of the main ones are already available. You know, some people are like, oh, I don't watch virtual cinema, or there's no theaters open near me. Well, one of these is on Netflix, and one of these is on, is it Amazon? Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So you can connect. So let's start with the first one. You saw this 1 million years ago at the Middleburg Virtual Film Festival. I had nothing to do with that because I can't stomach the idea of a virtual film festival. But I finally caught up with Herself. Now, Herself is the one that you can watch right now on Amazon Prime Video. And Herself is technically a foreign film, Hannah, technically a foreign film, even though it's in English. It is set and filmed and takes place in Ireland. Single mother Sandra, played by Claire Dunn, escapes her abusive partner with her two young children, I mean young children, only to find herself trapped in the bureaucracy of temporary accommodation. After months of struggling, she draws inspiration from one of her daughter's bedtime stories and gets the big idea to build her own house, self-build an affordable home. She finds an architect. You know, he provides her with plans, and she happens to be offered land and a nice cushy loan from her employer. She's a cleaner for a doctor who is on the mend, who's convalescing. She finds a building contractor who's willing to help, and she's got a bunch of friends that will chip in weekends. But as her past rears its head in the form of Gary, played by Ian Lloyd Anderson, her abusive separated ex, her possessive ex. And as the bureaucrats fight actually against her independent spirit, you know, how dare you try to, just, you know, get around the dole, get around your benefits and build your own home? That's ridiculous. Will Sandra be able to rebuild her life from the ground up? What do you think, Hannah? Is it an intriguing watch to watch Sandra rebuild her life from the ground up?
I did. I mean, the kids, the two little girls are so cute in this. And so you're just rooting for this little family to just escape that abusive situation once and for all. And she's trying to, you know, pull herself up by her own bootstraps. She's got this independent spirit and you know, she wants to do the work. And it's almost like she's being, you know, challenged by the bureaucracy to not do what the most that she can to better her situation. And it's very frustrating. It reminded me a bit of, do you remember the 2016 drama, I, Daniel Blake? Did you ever see that one?
I never saw it.
It was excellent. It was this, you know, this guy who was sort of having to deal with the British welfare system and these employment issues and trying to get back to work. And he befriends some a young woman who's sort of going through the same housing crisis issues. And so it actually reminded me quite a bit of that one. And that, I would say, definitely go and watch I, Daniel Blake at some point if you can find it. But Herself is also very good. It was one of my favorites out of the Middleburg Film Festival. I gave it, I think, at least 3 out of 4 stars. I even might have been leaning towards 3.25 because it is just, yes, I know that you probably had issues with some courtroom scenes or some stuff that's a bit too cliched, but the performances are excellent. It's one of those bittersweet dramas that is just very engaging to watch. And so I really liked it.
You're right about the performances. Claire Dunn is phenomenal. I don't think I've seen her before. I know she had like a bit part in one of those Spider-Man films, but it was so bit, I don't remember her. She came up with the idea for the script and co-wrote the script. It's somewhat autobiographical. A friend of hers in Dublin was becoming homeless and entering this bureaucratic system. I don't think it was because of abuse. I just think it was because of lack of funding. But, you know, it addresses things that all big city problems have, which is lack of affordable housing, housing crunches. I did have a bigger problem with this film than you did. I only gave it a 2.5, is because it's a particular genre and they wrote it that way. They brought in the elements to make it the genre. It didn't have to have courtroom hysterics. It didn't have to have it, but they shoved it in there and it actually doesn't quite fit with the pluck and promise of the rest of the film. And you know, there's going to be promises and fallbacks and hopes shattered, and there's all of that, but it stuffs these certain things in here in a way that are just incongruent. And the only reason she's able to do this, and I mean, she's got this, you know, vim and verve. She wants to help herself. She doesn't want to be confined and defined by her problems. But the only way it works is because she gets this huge handout. Here's some land I'm not using. It's my backyard. Oh, here's the cushy loan you couldn't get from anywhere else. She just happens to be handed this stuff. And her biggest problem is like then just getting the right nails. You know, and of course, the soundtrack is mostly set to Sia, you know, these very gargantuan, spacey, inspirational, plucky songs. So I was, you know, at times it was cloying, but it's not terrible. All because of Claire's performance. And, you know, the direction's fine with Phyllida Lloyd. We've seen her a couple times. Odd that Phyllida Lloyd would take this because she extolled the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher, with Meryl Streep back in like 2011. And then she did the first Mamma Mia. So an odd, you know, she hops around. This is not her wheelhouse, but this is a low budget fare. There's obviously, they could not hire big, they were looking to get bigger name actors, but when they realized what the budget was, they're like, oh, you know what? Let's just stick to the local Irish folk. So yeah, script problems for me, but if you know this is, you know, your wheelhouse and this is your genre, you're not going to lose here.
Right. Yeah, no, and I do agree. I do feel that some things were, it was a little overstuffed with some of the more cloying elements that you refer to in terms of what's going on with her ex. And but it really, it's all about ultimately these issues that are prevalent in all these major cities and how they are solvable, though, under certain circumstances. There are different approaches, and we just need to be looking at some of these things differently, and the bureaucracy needs to be cut through in some way. And so I like that. That element is worth sort of rising to the top of why this is a still a very good drama. And I just think it's a very good choice. And the fact that it is on Amazon Prime, I would say if you have Amazon Prime, you might as well go ahead and take advantage of it to see this film, because you're not going to really go wrong.
No, not at all. Our second film is a documentary, and perhaps you've already heard about it because it's got some word of mouth buzz, even though it lacked for the longest time sufficient distribution. And I'm talking about The Dissident. You've heard of the main character of The Dissident because the film follows the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. He was Saudi Arabian. He was in exile. You know, it's odd that the film is called The Dissident because he wasn't one. You know, there's a guy who defines dissident in the film. It's like someone who's against the country. And Jamal was Saudi Arabia's biggest fan. He loved the country, just not its authoritarian royal family. And then, you know, that the other half of the film, other than charting the day or the rise of his assassination, is Saudi Arabia's effort, you know, to control international dissent. And you know, the what makes my blood boil about this film is not necessarily, you know, the brazen act of the assassination itself, which has really played itself out in the papers. If you subscribe to the Post, you know, you've seen the full page ads all the time because he was a Washington Post columnist. It's the backstory of this film. Brian Fogler, the director, is an Oscar winner. If you're a documentary filmmaker and you win an Oscar, you get distribution for your next film. It just happens. He won for Icarus. We talked about it on this show. Icarus exploded the Russian Olympic doping scandal. You know, it almost got him killed by Vladimir Putin. And then he goes out and makes this film, and his former distributor, Netflix wouldn't take it. They wouldn't take it. Neither would Amazon Prime Video, because it's widely believed this is due to those platforms' fear of offending the Saudi Arabian government and possibly losing subscribers. They care, of course, they care about their bottom line. You know, they're publicly traded companies, but man, they sell their director, their boy, down the river by not distributing his film. Finally, a smaller distribution company picked it up. But yes, it's mainly about what happened, how it happened, who did it, why they did it, and how they did it, of the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. What about you, Hannah? Did this bite you as much as it bit me?
It did. I mean, I was sort of just appalled and outraged at really understanding more about this story. But I think what the dissident has working against it is that I was like, didn't this movie already come out a few months ago? And then I realized that there was yet a different documentary called Kingdom of Silence that came out, I believe, in early October on this exact same topic. And so I think they might end up canceling each other out to some degree, even though when you do have, as you mentioned, a Oscar-winning director at the helm, the dissident will get and is getting a lot more for your consideration Oscar marketing play. And so maybe that will give the film a boost. But I did feel like we had already kind of heard more about this story a while back. But it's heartbreaking and sickening to watch because it really is showing you that there's no doubt that this was not just premeditated, but beyond the pale premeditated. I mean, that he was drawn into the consulate and into a meeting room that had a bone saw ready to basically dismember the guy and get rid of his body. And there's transcripts, and you're seeing these transcripts about what transpired in the final minutes and hours of this guy's life. And it just makes you mad. And so for no other reason than to just really understand how we kind of let the Saudi royal family just sort of get away with it because we were selling them a lot of weapons for a lot of money. It's very frustrating to watch. And this guy was slaughtered, kidnapped, dismembered, and tossed away. And the documentary plays out, I would say, a bit like this sort of political thriller, and you see all this spy game type stuff going on. But in the end, it's really just about saying, you know, he deserved better. He deserved justice. And the fact that it's a documentary that has these elements that are just so unbelievable just makes it even all the more difficult to watch. And so I do think, for the sake of Jamal Khashoggi and the others out there fighting for journalism and journalistic freedoms and for the people, I think that's really the key reason to watch at least either The Dissident and or Kingdom of Silence.
And yet, even though the subject is very compelling and you're drawn in and it's well made, The Dissident is not in my top five documentaries of the year. It's draggy, especially kind of in a more sullen first half. It's too long. It's a little over 2 hours, I think. It rambles. It repeats itself. And it, you know, when it ever talks about, you know, like tapping phones or something technological, it goes into those standard. You know, it looks like you're inside of Tron. You know, they've got. It looks like you're in the Matrix. It just they've got some graphic art up there to like, ooh, beeps and squeaks. And that's tried and true. That they didn't need to do that. But so if it didn't repeat it so much, and maybe if it was just 100 minutes instead of like 125,
I agree.
It would have been sharper. Probably would have pierced a little bit deeper.
I completely agree. That was one of my main notes about it, was that it should have been and could have been a lot tighter. I think I had the same issue with Icarus, if I recall.
Yeah, it was long. That
was too long too. That there were things that you could see that would be obviously easy to lift, but weren't. And so I agree. To me, it was the second half of this film that got me. The first half was very draggy.
All right, now we're going to split up. I'm going to talk about something I saw. You're going to talk about something you saw. And I'm going to talk about some Oscar buzz. I'm going to talk about a Best Actress potential nominee in Vanessa Kirby. I'm going to talk about Pieces of a Woman, which you can watch right now on Netflix. Martha and Sean. Martha and Sean are a Boston couple on the verge of parenthood whose lives change irrevocably when a home birth ends in unimaginable tragedy. Thus begins a year-long odyssey for Martha, and that's played by Kirby, who must navigate her grief while working through her fractious relationships with her husband, played by Shia LaBeouf, who's been in the news lately, and her domineering mother, played by Ellen Burstyn, who's also getting supporting actress buzz, and along with the publicly vilified midwife, played by Molly Parker, whom she must face in court. Directed by Cornel Mundrusco, who I saw one of his previous films, I think back in 2014, it was called White God. It's about a dog, and kind of it took place in Hungary. I think it was in Hungarian, and the rising of the dogs. I never forgot that movie. It's so visceral. But executive produced by Martin Scorsese. Pieces of a Woman is pretty much the most depressing movie I've ever seen in my entire life. And I've seen a lot of depressing movies, and this one takes the cake. Even though it has, you know, this Oscar buzz of performance just because of the things Vanessa Kirby has to go through, namely childbirth. This movie's just a miserable time in the theater, if you know what I mean. However, it's got a 24-minute single take scene. The entire birth from like the first contractions to, you know, it emerging into the world is a 24-minute single take scene. It's fascinating. I love when films do that. It just takes the cake. I love everything about it. This is at the Venice Film Festival, where Kirby won the Best Actress prize. And, you know, if you do that, you're automatically in the Oscar talk. And Mondrusco, you know, he's a theater guy. He's an opera guy. In fact, Pieces of a Woman was a play first, but only two scenes. There was like the birthing scene and a later fight over a dinner scene. That was only the play. The film script is much broader, much larger than that. And you're saying, wait a minute, I don't know Vanessa Kirby. How do I not know Vanessa Kirby? Well, this is her first leading film role. You've seen her in supporting roles. Did you watch the first two seasons of The Crown? I know I didn't. She was Princess Margaret. She was in Mission Impossible Fallout. You know, she was the White Widow. And allegedly, that character's coming back in the next two Mission Impossible films. Other buzz you might have heard, you get to see Shia LaBeouf's Little LaBeouf, if you know what I mean. if that draws you into the film. But I'm not saying run out and see this movie. In fact, I'm saying if you're at a particular point in your life, maybe you're planning on having kids. Maybe your wife is pregnant. Maybe you just had kids. Don't watch this movie. Don't watch this movie. It's not good for you. You don't want to see this movie. If you have to see everything that has buzz, or if she comes out on the nomination list, okay, fine. I get it. You have to see the movie. But if she doesn't, if she's not on the Best Actress top five, don't watch this movie. It's not a good time. You won't feel better about yourself. You're not going to recommend it to any of your friends. I'm not kidding. This is a rough ride. So, Hannah, do you want to go see it?
No. Is it more depressing than Beanpole? Remember how hard that one was to watch?
I remember how hard Beanpole was. And
yeah,
this is right there. It's right there.
See, there you have it. If it's right up there with Beanpole, I don't need to see it. I will just...
Will you see it if and when she is nominated?
Yes, I probably will. Just because that's just the nature of the beast right now. And you know, I want to be well prepared when we fill out our very unusual Oscar polls this spring. But beyond that, it's like I watched Beanpole too, and I hated the fact that I watched it, but I had to. And
Beanpole's a good movie. I mean, it's hard to watch, but Beanpole's a very, very, very almost great movie. This is
I would hope. Which is then it makes it a shame that it's getting all that kind of awards buzz, because it's very frustrating to me when not so great movies, you know, you have to watch them because of individual performances. Takes me back. I think there was even a Twitter thread about that this week. Like, what happens when you have great performances in a not so great movie? And the one that came to mind for me was Meryl Streep in Iron Lady. And so there are times where, you know, you just sort of go, you suck it up and you watch a movie for the performances, even though the movie itself just is not for you. So I'll take the bullet, perhaps, if there's nominations, to watch it on behalf of some of my friends, but I'm not looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm not even telling my wife that this exists. Like, this is just not good for anybody's mental health who's in, you know, like, childbearing age. It's so rough. Maybe not like Beanpole rough, but it's rough.
Okay, well, the one I saw, I can guarantee you, you do not have to see Charlie Come award season. There is no way that anything relating to this film would make it onto anyone. Maybe a Razzie, but Stars Fell on Alabama, and it's available on demand. It is about as cliched of a romantic dramedy as you could find. It's the type of film that under normal circumstances we would expect to see in the beginning of January, pretty much when all the award season movies would be kind of on their, you know, sort of petering out a little bit, and they would distributors would just kind of be burying some of these films. Stars Fell on Alabama is one of those. It really would never belong in a theater. It really is, if you'd already cycled through all of your Hallmark, Lifetime, Netflix Christmas movies, this one has no holiday. There's a high school reunion instead, but it's that same type of level of drama, but with really no-name actors, unless you count James Maslow, who some will recall on Nickelodeon from Big Time Rush, the boy band.
No.
And he looked familiar, and I'm like, why does this guy look so familiar? And then I realized, yes, it was... I actually met Big Time Rush many years ago at an event, and so that's why he's sort of grown up now. And James Maslow is the leading man in this film. He plays a Hollywood agent, very successful, who is supposed to go to his high school reunion in Alabama, and he doesn't have a date. He's like the only one in his circle. You know, all these high school friends are still in this small town, Alabama. You know, they have stayed there since graduation. They've gotten married, had kids. But then you have this successful agent, Bryce Dixon. Gotta love that name. Bryce needs a date to take to his reunion. And then on a whim, he tells some pals that he's actually dating his biggest client, Madison Bell, and she's this starlet who's on the cusp of breaking through into, you know, like superstardom. And so, of course, it just, you know, Bryce is lucky enough to realize that that this client of his is actually about to break up with her rock star boyfriend. And so she's kind of, you know, got nothing better to do for the weekend. And so she does join him for these high school reunion shenanigans. And of course, they discover that they really do like each other. And it's not just a pretend, let's, you know, get together for the weekend and make everyone believe that we're dating. They actually, within 24 hours, develop very strong feelings. It's all very predictable, very cliched, has no business running the 103 minutes that it did. 90 minutes would have been more than enough. And so, as you know, Charlie, one of my favorite romantic dramedies has a very similar name, Sweet Home Alabama. And I would just pray that nobody feels that they are getting anything even remotely close to Sweet Home Alabama with Stars Fell on Alabama. So in other words, to make it very, very brief, Charlie, don't even go anywhere near this one.
No, don't worry. I did watch the trailer, and no one's going to see this movie. Nobody's going to see this movie. More, what, you know, millions of more people will see Holiday. no one's going to watch this movie. I don't think we have to worry about that. I don't.
Unless they saw, I don't know, does James Maslow have a fan base? You know, apparently he was on Dancing with the Stars and Celebrity Big Brother. So, you know, it doesn't get much bigger than that.
I've never heard of this guy. I don't know what a big time rush is. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, see, that's because you didn't have your kids are too young. So I would say that anyone who's around 16 right now would be very well aware of Big Time Rush. But that's not the age group. They're not going to go and hunt out Stars Fell on Alabama either.
Well, sorry I had to do that. Thanks for taking one for the team. Let's talk about, all right, now we're just going to do catch up mode. You know, right now we're in the thick of all these screeners, catch up, all the buzz, see the stuff before we vote kind of stuff. And one movie that came out a couple months ago, it's on Netflix though, you can watch it now, that both Hannah and I watched this week is called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And there's a reason I watched it, is because I can connect with it. Now, normally you wouldn't think I would connect with a black and white film about an African-American woman in New York City. What do I have in common with her? Well, we both just turned 40. That's one of them, which is why I was identifying with her. She's in a rut. She's a teacher. She's not a good teacher. She's a playwright. She's an okay playwright, but she's selling her soul to the devil for a little bit of commercial attention. And she's just lost. She's lost. And she thinks, you know what? When I was young, I was a pretty good rhyme flower. I was a good rapper. I was a good hip hopper. And she jumps back into the scene. And man, that's when the movie takes off. I really, really, really liked and enjoyed the 40-year-old version. I love black and white films. I really liked watching Rada Blank. Never heard of her before. You know, this is her feature film debut. So she's winning all these breakthrough artist awards, first feature film director awards. And she's great. She's like playing herself. It's such a fun watch. You know, there's some performance issues with some supporting characters, but you know what? She had to make this movie probably on, you know, had to make $20 go far, if you know what I mean. So a huge two thumbs up for me for the 40-year-old version.
Yeah, I was surprised by this one. I wasn't sure what to make of it, but it was quite witty and very creative. It was fun, but also moving and poignant. And yeah, she plays, you know, she's this down on her luck playwright, and she's thinking, how do I regain and find my voice again? You know, that she had these ambitions and somehow all of a sudden she blinked and she was turning 40 and felt like she wasn't, you know, accomplishing what she had meant to accomplish. And, you know, she teaches in Harlem and these kids are like, you know, that whole cliche of those who can't teach. And so they kind of let her have it over the fact that, you know, she's teaching playwriting and is a playwright, but isn't actually, you know, doesn't have anything out there. And so then that's when she kind of makes this decision to sell her soul just to get something produced. And it's a very just it's relatable on certain levels. And I liked it too. And she goes by when she switches into rapper mode, she becomes Rodimus Prime, and that propelled me to try and figure out what my rapper name would be. And so I came up with DaReal Hannah B. DaReal Hannah B. So I put my name into a rapper name generator to try and find that out. But yes, I absolutely also, this was a huge success at Sundance, and I can see why. And so I do think 40-year-old version, V-E-R-S-I-O-N, is definitely worth checking out if you've got Netflix.
Two other things I caught up with this week, and they're both on Hulu. The first one's a documentary, which has already won a couple of one of those regional critics' prizes. It's called The Painter and the Thief, a Czech painter actually living in Norway. This takes place in Oslo. Paints some paintings. She's going to sell them for like 20,000 euro. Has a gallery viewing and everything, and they're stolen. And we find out who the thief is, and we find out why he did it. They form a relationship, the painter and the thief, and we follow their lives over the course of like 2 years. And I don't want to give anything away, but it's a fascinating watch. Not necessarily in my top five, but it could be number six. The final shot of the film is the best final shot of any film this year, regular movie, documentary, or otherwise. The final shot is just, it's the best one of the year. And the second one.
That's another one.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that's another one that's gotten quite a bit of buzz. And so if it makes the final cut in for Oscar consideration, then I will definitely watch it.
Yeah, fair enough. Second one's Palm Springs. And if I knew what it was about, I would have watched it when it came out. It was at Sundance, and it won the award for the largest film purchase at Sundance ever. The previous record was $17.5 million. This one was $17.5 million and 69 cents. Starring Andy Samberg. It's a time loop movie. It's Groundhog Day. It's Groundhog Day, and it takes place over the course of one day at a wedding. Andy Samberg is caught in a time loop every day at the same wedding, and it's a romantic comedy. It's a romantic drama. And J.K. Simmons is in it. I really enjoyed Palm Springs. I laughed. It's not great. No, if it gets a nod for anything, it'll be screenplay. But it's so good that it's worth anybody's time. It's on Hulu. Go check it out.
Yeah, that's another one that that I probably will try and catch up on, because it did appear on quite a few, not necessarily in the top 10, but on honorable mention lists for the year's best films. And it kind of, I don't know what happened when it first came out, but it must have just sort of blown right by us. And so I do feel that it's gotten enough positive buzz from folks that whose opinion I respect that I probably should go back and watch it maybe when some of these other really, really weak ones in mid to late January start rolling out, and I'll go back and catch up on that one instead.
You know, you could have watched that instead of Stars Fell on Alabama.
I know, but then I wouldn't have been able to remind you, you know, that you really need to see Sweet Home Alabama.
Why would I do that? I've seen that.
Anyway, and so while you were watching all of those, I was doing a little bit of Netflix and chilling myself. I watched Death to 2020. Some people might say too soon, a mockumentary about 2020. It had some real laugh out loud moments, though, and some news folks that I know, they definitely seem to enjoy it more than others because there's really lots to identify with. But it's funny. You got Samuel L. Jackson and Hugh Grant as these talking heads. Lisa Kudrow is a press secretary, and Tracy Ullman is absolutely brilliant as the queen. And so it really is just about what a god-awful year 2020 was. And so it's just a kind of a quick, fun watch. And so it doesn't hurt, I don't think, to watch it. I finished The Queen's Gambit, which, as everyone has said, was excellent. I like when you can actually watch, binge a series, and the story ends. And you don't have to think about the next 15 seasons that you may or may not catch. And then the other one that I watched from beginning to end was season one of Bridgerton, which I think is trending number one on Netflix right now. It is a Victorian soap opera. Just make sure the kids are completely out of the room when episode four rolls around, because that's when it takes this shift towards Downton Abbey meets 50 Shades of Grey. So you just have to be ready for that. But yeah, Bridgerton is sort of is the Victorian soap opera to watch right now, and there will be more. And so apparently it's based on a whole series of historical romance novels that center around this one particular family. And so each season could conceivably revolve around another character. And so we have at least for sure a season two to look forward to.
Well, you have my attention on episode four. But no, I really don't get to watch a lot of television just because of all the movies I watch. So I don't plan on watching any of them. But Queen's Gambit does sound good, though.
Yeah, no, Queen's Gambit, definitely. And Bridgerton, you know, your wife will tell you when she's gotten episodes four, five, and six for sure. So that's pretty much, I would just say, though, out of all of them, my favorite probably for this week, I think the strongest overall is Herself.
If we're just talking about the ones, you know, the first three, I'd have to give it to The Dissident. Herself is just not strong enough. I'd give it to the documentary on this one.
And just in case anyone did skip it in theaters as they were supposed to, Fatale is now available Prime Video, video on demand, premium, which means you probably have to pay for it. That's the Hilary Swank Fatal Attraction wannabe that we talked about a few weeks ago that I saw. Psychological thriller, murder mystery thing. So it's another option for you.
Yeah, not going to catch up with that.
Good enough. All right. So that is, I believe, a wrap for this edition of The Cinema Clash. Thanks so much for listening. As always, you can reach us anytime through our website, thecinemaclash.com, or on Twitter at The Cinema Clash. Till next time, stay safe, wear a mask, get vaccinated when you can.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.